This is a session on metaphor. I've been reading a book. I'm excited about the book, and I just decided that I wanted to share some of that excitement with you. The book is Sally McFaig's book, Metaphorical Theology, Models of God and Religious Language, and it's both in the bookstore and on reserve. I'm not going to do a book review tonight. I just want to tell you what stimulated my desire to share this session with you. I want us to have some fun with language. I also hope that there are some insights to be gleaned by taking a closer look, to use a metaphor. If I could start where Marilyn did and where we all did with Vespers. I don't sing as beautifully as she does, but Jesus Christ is the light of the world. That's a metaphor.
Darkness can overcome.
Stay with us, Lord, for it is evening.
And the day is almost over.
The session will begin in an hour from now after Vespers is finished, yeah. Let your light scatter the darkness and illumine your church. Every one of those phrases has a metaphor in it. A metaphor is a figure of speech by which one thing is likened to another. The different thing is spoken of as if it were the other. Jesus Christ is the light of the world. Milton, a person is a light. One thing is understood from the perspective of something else. Jesus Christ is like a light, is what we are saying, in some respects. Provides guidance, maybe, or illumination for the church, scatters our darkness, is the way we've talked about it. In winter program, we're doing a series of sessions on ethics, and we ended up the first session with a question: when we think about ethics and morality, what do we think with, or how do we think? And what I want to contend tonight with that inflated title, Metaphor is a Clue to the Knowing of All Relevant Knowledge, that is that we think metaphorically, but not just about ethics and morality, about anything at all that we think. We think with metaphors. The Greek is meta. What is a metaphor? And Al asked me, what is a meta, you know? Well, meta is a word meaning over, and pherein is a word meaning to carry. When one thing is carried over to another. Now take a look at the sheet that I passed out, and we'll just spend a little bit of time with some metaphors. I was going to mark on the board, it's too late now, but I want to declare tomorrow, in addition to homecoming, which is a metaphor. It is. What? Homecoming. It's like, what is homecoming about? It's like a school, returning to your school is like coming back to a family, coming home.
Is there anything?
Well, that's a good question. tomorrow we'll declare Metaphor Awareness Day. All right, and bring to the attention of your neighbor tomorrow. Every time your you all wonder Mary's question whether there is anything which isn't a metaphor, but often bring to your neighbor's attention when she or he is using a metaphor. Now, a simile is also when you use dissimilar things, but to liken them to one another. It's more characteristic of a metaphor, however, that it's often hidden. At least a simile is very easy to spot, to use a metaphor.
Bringing it to your neighbor's attention.
Yeah, it is. So a simile, you might say, tears flowed like wine. You can hear that. You don't always hear the metaphor, argument is war. Take a look at your sheet. But I want you to listen to people when they argue. And listen for what is being used to carry it over in the argument. I've just taken some of these from a book that I'm also reading, Metaphors We Live By, by George Lakoff and Mark Johnson. So we hear things like, your claims are indefensible. He attacked every weak point in my argument. His criticisms were right on target. This is all an image of war that's being used in argument. I demolished her argument. I've never won an argument with her. You disagree? Okay, shoot. If you use that strategy, he'll wipe you out. He shot down all my arguments. All of that is war as a metaphor. Or take a look. time is money, or time is a limited resource, or time is a commodity. That's all ways of trying to characterize time. Now, in some cultures, time isn't money, and it isn't a limited commodity. It is in our culture. So we talk about wasting time, or this gadget will save you hours, or I don't have the time to give you, or how did you spend your time these days, or that flat tire cost me an hour. I've invested a lot of time in her. I don't have enough time to spare. That you're running out of time. You need to budget your time. Put aside some time for ping pong. Is that worth your while? Do you have much time left? He's living on borrowed time. You don't use your time profitably. I lost a lot of time when I got sick. Thank you for your time. Time is money, time is a limited resource, time is a commodity. One place from which we take many metaphors is from the body. So I want just to start with a couple of things, and I'd like to have you add to the things that I start with. We try to stay in touch. If you just take skin, I'll just start with skin. We need to get in touch with that. You rub me the wrong way. You are thick-skinned. You get under my skin. It was a touching experience. I didn't have a feel for that. Can you go on from there, take some other part of the body, or stay with skin?
You're thick-headed.
Thick-headed.
Flesh that out some.
Flesh that out a little bit.
Said you're a flake.
A flake? Like dandruff or something? You're a pain in the neck.
Or somewhere else,
yes.
That was an earful?
That was an earful. Or that was an eyeful.
I've got my eye on you.
I've got my eye on you. I've got my eye on you. Missing one eye. You're the apple of my eye.
Stick out like a sore thumb.
Stick out like a sore thumb.
It'll cost you an arm and a leg.
It'll cost you an arm and a leg.
You're sure nosy.
Leg up on.
Yeah, got a leg up on something or other. I saw Linda come in, not just for Linda's sake, but for all of ours. A page from Lakoff and Johnson. Metaphors and about ideas. First one is ideas are food. And after that, ideas are people, ideas are plants, ideas are products, and ideas are commodities. I won't read all of them, but let me just bring to the surface, to use a metaphor, ideas are food. What he said left a bad taste in my mouth. All this paper has in it are raw facts, half-baked ideas, and warmed-over theories. There are too many facts here for me to digest them. I just can't swallow that claim. That argument smells fishy. Let me stew over that for a while. Now there's a theory you can really sink your teeth into. We need to let that idea percolate for a while. That's food for thought. He's a voracious reader. We don't need to spoon feed our students. He devoured the book. Let's let that idea simmer on the back burner for a while. This is the meaty part of the paper. Let that idea gel for a while. That idea has been fermenting for years. That's all ideas are food. Quickly, ideas are plants. His ideas have finally come to fruition. That idea died on the vine. That's a budding theory. It will take years for that idea to come to full flower. He views chemistry as a mere offshoot of physics. Mathematics has many branches. The seeds of the great ideas were planted in his youth. She has a fertile imagination. Here's an idea that I'd like to plant in your mind. He has a barren mind. All right. The mind is a machine. Look back at the sheet, just for the fun of it. Sometimes when we talk about the mind, we use a metaphor, mind and machine. We're still trying to grind out the solution to the problem. My mind just isn't operating today. Boy, are the wheels turning now. I'm a little rusty today. We've been working on this problem all day, and now we're running out of steam. Then a reminder of some religious language. This is my body, broken for you. That's the same way of knowing as saying, I'm a little rusty today. Jesus is Lord. As a metaphor, Jesus is in some respects like a Lord, is what it says. Truly, this is the Son of God, the body of Christ. The Lord is full of compassion and mercy, slow to anger, and of great kindness. That's a person is someone, a person has those qualities or can have as a person. Compassion, kindness. The Lord is like a person who is full of compassion. Jesus Christ is the light of the world. Okay, now I want to explore the dynamic of metaphor a bit, because I think there's some very interesting and potentially far-ranging implications from that. What we've said then is that your metaphor is the use of a term for one thing to describe another because of some kind of similarity that exists between them or between their relations to other things. The Lord is my shepherd. If you ask me, what is your Lord like? I answer, there are similarities to a shepherd. I mean, probably something like a protector, or my Lord is like a guide, or my Lord cares for me like a shepherd cares for sheep. Or if I say, the snow blankets the ground. Blanket is the way I talk about the relationship of snow and ground. It's soft, maybe even it's a picture of something that's kind of warm, despite the fact that the snow, it's a kind of warm-like. The earth is sleeping, and the snow offers it some kind of protection and warmth. It's still, it's cuddly even. Snow can be violent. Snow can even kill. Think of an avalanche. But when I say the snow blankets the ground, you don't hear that killing and that violence. That's not what you hear. What you hear is something peaceful, something quiet. It comes from the metaphor, a blanket. Your mind automatically understands the relationship when the metaphor is invoked. You automatically associate when that word is said, and you think about the snow and the ground in a relationship like a blanket, instead of the snow and the ground in a relationship as you would have with something else portraying the workings of an avalanche. Metaphor shapes your perception. It shapes your understanding. Well, this is how we know things. One thing is used to understand another thing because of some thread of similarity, to use a metaphor, between them. I believe in God the Father Almighty is a metaphor. God is in some significant respects similar to a human father. That's not different. That's the same way of knowing as when I say atoms are like this arrangement of billiard balls, and then I show you the model in the physics lab. The atoms aren't billiard balls, and God isn't a human father, but in some significant respects, God is like a human father, and atoms are like this arrangement of billiard balls. In both cases, you're using metaphor. Now, note something here. There are two terms. There's the thing to be described, the Lord, as in the Lord is my shepherd, or God as my father. And there's the other term, which is that term which is used to elucidate or describe. That which is used to get to know, the first term. So, the Lord is shepherd or father. Note something very carefully here. One of the terms is well known, or at least better known, than the other term. The other term is lesser known or relatively unknown. And you, in a metaphor, you move from the better known to the lesser known in order to describe, illumine, to use a metaphor, that lesser known. Father, human father, is the better known and is used to say something about the lesser known, the mysterious God. Jesus is a somewhat mysterious figure we can know better by using something very familiar to us, light. The movement in knowing, in a metaphor, is from the known to the unknown, from the familiar to the less familiar, in order to know the latter. And so Aristotle says, midway between the unintelligible and the commonplace, it is metaphor which most produces knowledge. I'm going to say that again. Midway between the unintelligible and the commonplace, it is metaphor which most produces knowledge. God is beyond our intelligibility, yet we would know God and have some experience of God. Is there anything in our commonplace which would tell us something of the mysterious God? And we say, yes, God is in some ways similar to something common, as a father. Note also, and very important, that the two terms, the better known and the lesser known, are not identical. One term both is like and is not like the other term. If they were identical, you wouldn't have any reason to be employing metaphor. In some ways, snow is like a blanket. In some ways, snow is not like a blanket. Snow is not made of cloth. Snow is not made on a loom. Snow does not come in as many colors as blankets. Snow doesn't store as well in the attic. You can't get $4.50 at the garage sale for snow. It's just that in some respects, snow is like a blanket. In other respects, it is not. Jesus Christ is the light of the world. In some ways, that means Jesus is like a light, guidance for my journey. In some ways, Jesus is not like a light. Light doesn't care a bit for me. If I want to say Jesus cares for me, I'm going to have to change and find another metaphor. Maybe I will say the Lord is my shepherd, in order to talk about that, get to know that aspect, or express that. Our Father in heaven, in some ways God is like a father, but in some ways God is not like a father, is what metaphor says. Fathers don't make the sun shine, fathers don't make the rain fall, fathers don't make plants sprout. Nothing against fathers. I'm not a lousy father just because I can't keep the sun over Buckskin Mountain until 8 o'clock like I'd like to, and like my son would like me to do. It's just that fathers don't do that. That's not part of being father. It doesn't belong there. If you want to say it is God's power, that is the power that makes the sun shine and the rain to fall and the just and the unjust and the seeds to sprout, you'll have to find a metaphor with a similarity to those things. Maybe you will say God is like a creator. Tonight in Vespers, when we substituted Creator, Christ, and Holy Spirit for Father, Son, and Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, that was not one as the equivalent of the other. That was changing the meaning. Because a metaphor is always only partial. It has to be. A mighty fortress is our God, a bulwark never failing. It can tell you some things about God, but in some ways God is not like a mighty fortress. My point is that when we use metaphor, we always mean the better known thing is the better known something is and is not like the thing that we're seeking to know. We're not talking about total identity or perfect likeness. If that were the case, we wouldn't use one kind of thing in order to describe a different kind of thing. Now, is there non-metaphorical language for knowing something? It was sort of Mary's question in a version. Is everything known only by metaphor? Do we only learn by borrowings, by associations, by analogies, by these kind of connections that metaphor provides? Of course, not entirely. I learned from some first-hand experience, to use a metaphor. I touched the stone, I learned the stove, and I learned something that way without the use of a metaphor. I also learned by example and imitation, although I think those two are kind of a metaphor. How do I grow old? I'd like to grow old in the way my Uncle Richard and Aunt Maxine are growing old. In some ways, example or imitation is a kind of metaphor. It won't be exactly the way they grow old, but there are some things which are like the way I would like to grow old. But let me just explore the case that, to use a metaphor, that all our language grows, to use a metaphor, by metaphor. Just some insight here by observing how kids learn language. How do children or adults learn? If you have an object in your hand and the child has never seen that object before, or even if the child has seen that object before but it doesn't yet have a name, how will you describe and name that object? It'll probably go something like, well, it's kind of like such and such. Yep, but it's also a little bit like, then you name something else. Eventually, you'll agree to something that it's like, and that will be its name. If it, let's say it had no name before, it's, and then you will have invented the arm of a chair. Or maybe you will have invented the leg of a table. Or maybe you will have invented the face of a clock. Or the tongue of a shoe. Or the eye of the proverbial lost needle of haystack and camel fame. Or to stay with just a person as a source of the metaphor, maybe you will have invented the head of the bed. Or the face of the cliff, or the eye of the storm, or the teeth of the comb, or the lip of the pitcher, or the arm of the sea, or the last leg of the journey, or the brow of the hill. Those who get to name own, and the rest of the folks live with the results. When the next child in the next generations asks you and your first partner what this is, you will answer, wow, that's just the face of the clock. And you won't even think about the origin in the metaphor. You'll only remember what has now become the conventional label. What will you have forgotten? You will have forgotten the is, you will not have forgotten the is, you will have forgotten the is not in the metaphor. The front of the clock is in some respects like a face, and you'll call it the face of the clock. But in some respects it is not like a face. And if anyone wears a clock on their shoulders tomorrow, you'll be keenly aware that a human face is not like a clock. in some respects. To see how language grows by metaphor, it's often helpful to learn another language. It becomes very vivid to use a metaphor, how this happens. Maybe it won't be the tongue of the shoe. Maybe if you translate it, it'll be the handle. Maybe someone won't be the apple of your eye, but will instead be the thump of your heart. I have Christian friends in Zimbabwe who sometimes say, "God, my dear grandmother." And they're doing just exactly what the Hebrew did when the Hebrew said, "Yahweh, our God, is a mighty warrior." Language happens by naming an unknown by way of something known. And our imagination plays an enormous role in that. We're unfinished animals, and we construct much of our world by way of metaphor, which is really imaginative rationality. But invariably, the conventional label loses the original tension of the metaphor, the tension of is and is not. What else is lost when metaphor becomes conventional label? Oftentimes the original power of the metaphor is lost. A metaphor, by associating something from one thing to a different thing, is the stuff of discovery. It's the stuff of novelty. It's the stuff of new insight. As a living metaphor is a way you find out something new that you hadn't seen before. It's the stuff of illumination. Can you imagine what it must have been like when some folks who hadn't heard it before heard their rabbi on the eve of the death of his own body say, when he took a common loaf of bread and wine, "This is my body broken for you"? For us, even with the power that it still has, it has easily become convention. But can you imagine what that meant when that was heard the first time in such circumstances? Okay, then I want some time to discuss. Let me make a couple more points. There's an intriguing thing to ask is whether there are any significant notions that are without metaphorical roots, to use a metaphor, that aren't created by use of other and different words. And I'm going to take what is the most unmetaphorical sounding verb that I can think of, namely the verb to be. No image there, no picture when you hear the verb to be. It just is, you know. There's nothing there, no clue, like the arm of a chair, or God the Father Almighty, or Fred is a basket case. It's just to be, okay? Well, it turns out that to be comes from the Sanskrit word bhu, to grow, while the Sanskrit, or while the English forms am, as in I am, and is, he or she is, have evolved from Sanskrit asmi, meaning to breathe. So our most nondescript verb evolves from a time when no independent word yet existed for sheer existence, and folks could only say that something grows, or that something breathes. And I don't know, I mean, I just don't know, but my guess is that most of the words we use are metaphors where the original meanings have been rubbed away. Or to use Julian Jayne's own metaphor about language that no longer images its own originating metaphor. Quote, abstract words are ancient coins whose concrete images in the busy give and take of talk have worn away with use. Traditional labels are simply old metaphors. Human and humus both derive from earth. A human is a creature of the ground. Earth humus is the earth. And if we remember our finitude, our dust-like character, we might possess humility. But we've forgotten what the metaphor of earth was for the words human, humus, and humility, all of which are closely related. So language grows by metaphor, but we often lose the originating images when the once familiar, the lesser known item, becomes the familiar one. It becomes the conventional one and is itself probably in turn used for new language. Did that get through to you? Can you own it? Or do you want to set it aside or simply put it on the back burner for a while? Final point. People often collapse similarity into identity. They forget the tension of is and is not in a metaphor. They collapse similarity into identity. A guest this summer asked me after an evening forum on inclusive language, do you really worship a mother god? And I said, no, but the god I worship is in some respects like a mother. The distinction, I think, was lost because, at least as far as I could tell from the conversation, God either is a mother or is not. And since the person was certain that God is father, it's not possible that God is also like a mother. Similarity and dissimilarity, which is the origin of saying God is like a father, in some respects like, in some respects not like, was lost, and similarity was collapsed into identity. We forget the in some respects is like and in some respects is not like. Sometimes we overlook images that are, when we think about them, are a little bit striking as kind of funny. Jesus saying, I am a chicken. We don't often think of that. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem. How oft would I have gathered you under my wings like a mother hen, and you would not. Well, no one makes the mistake there. No one says Jesus is a chicken. But many times we do collapse similarity into identity. And it very often happens with God as father. Or I imagine in some traditions, God as mother. I think the Hebrew poets were just wise. They just piled up metaphors, images for God on top of one another to try to get at this or that aspect of the mysterious God. But I also wonder if, and Vern maybe want to say something, if the Hebrew prophets weren't very wary, and poets weren't very wary of absolutizing any one image of God, because that always bordered on idolatry. You had to constantly say, we do not, cannot know the identity of God. All we can do is say God is like, in some respects, a father or a thunder or a lion, or this one is the lamb of God, or this one is the lion of Judah, or God is like a mountain. So metaphors, finally, highlight and hide. If I think of argument in terms of war, then I will respond in argument that way. I'll carry out argument that way. If I didn't use war imagery for argument, and switch to something else, let me back up a minute, use a metaphor. If I use war imagery, my use of war imagery also hides the fact that argument might be carried out in some cooperative manner, like a game, that both might win if each helped the other. Argument is war highlights some things, but it hides other things. To say Jesus is Lord highlights the world of power, highlights rule, highlights allegiance. To say Jesus as Lord hides Jesus as light, or Jesus as healer, or maybe Jesus as suffering friend. Lord is a good metaphor for highlighting some things about Jesus. It will hide other things, because metaphor always means only a partial description. Said differently, metaphors make possible our knowing, but at the same time, they limit our knowing. If I use a machine model to understand society or the mind, I will understand much by way of that. That will lead me into understanding something that I wouldn't understand if I didn't use those metaphors. But I will hide, if I use a machine model for society or mind, I will hide from my knowing that which another metaphor might open up, society as an organism, or the mind as an artist rather than a computer. I will know some things, but I will hide others. The limits of our knowing are, for the most part, the limits of our language. If you enrich your metaphorical range, you also see some things new that you didn't see before. You see some things that you did see before differently. But there isn't any comprehensive metaphor. All of them are limited. All of them are partial. I keep saying the last point. This is the last point. Official acceptable culture is the metaphors of the powerful. If men have dominating power, then you can expect the dominating metaphors in a society to be male sympathetic. If whites have dominating power, then you can expect the way in which things are viewed, expressed, understood to be in keeping with that. Or if Indians have dominating power, then the understanding of the world and expression of the world will reflect that. Metaphors exhibit the interests of those who get to do the naming and their world. Okay, I'll just quit. I had several things that I jotted down as I thought about possible discussion topics. One would be just to discuss a little bit more the workings of metaphor, the implications of metaphor haven't been discussed. Another thing would be meaning for religious language. If we have no language for God except metaphorical language, and I don't think we do, or we can talk about some more characteristics of metaphor, whatever you wish. I'm intrigued by the parables, which are kind of extended metaphors. The kingdom of heaven is like, and then you have an extended metaphor. It'd be interesting to ask whether Jesus tells a lot of parables of the kingdom, because no one parable of the kingdom will suffice. You have to always say something in addition and something else in order to say something about the lesser known, namely God and the kingdom of God, the kingdom itself, of course, being a metaphor, one that we change in the service, in the vespers. And when we changed it, we also changed. We didn't find something that was the equivalent of kingdom, we changed the meaning by changing the metaphor.
To me, one of the most important things about metaphor, about language at all, is just about not being convinced the whole language is metaphor, is that there are so many implications for a society that we aren't even aware of just by the language that we use, that we just assume that this is how we talk about it, so this is how we use it. And this is sort of neat stuff to think about, the idea of metaphor, as useful as it is, also hiding some things. Mm. I think that's something I think about a lot. I appreciate particularly things on time as money and commodity, thinking about David Bellis' session on what is time. And in that, he really made the point that we can't assume that this is the only way things are, but we do assume that.
Yeah.
I mean, you just look at the world a certain way and you think that that is
the... Yeah, it's given. That's its nature.
Yeah.
It's the metaphorical theology, that by the title, does it have as its premise that it is the only way we talk about God? Is it words about God in a technical sense theology, or is it metaphorical language about faith and that's not a good way to ask the question. What's the primary premise of the book that started you on this? That it's God's language primarily?
Well, that's what the book
is
about, and it wants to, by investigating the nature of metaphor, see the implications for God, for our talk about God and what that does to other notions of theology. I don't know, does that answer your question, John?
Yeah, I guess so.
In addition to talking about the nature of metaphor, and then especially highlighting the nature of parables, and talking about Jesus as a parable of God, which is kind of an interesting and helpful notion in there, it talks about how so much of our language is elaboration of metaphor. So models, for example, are really extended or elaborated metaphors, and some other kind of technical terms now, paradigms and theories and so on, are really elaborated, extended, and related metaphors to one another. But she has some characteristics about a metaphor, about it's always indirect knowing. It's always, you know something through something else. Well, what does that mean for the way in which we think about God? It's always, as I've emphasized, things are like, but things are also unlike, so you have to keep it open-ended. It's always incomplete. There's always an element of human imagination, of human construct involved. Well, what does that mean if that's the way in which the language works? It pursues that. So what is the notion of scripture then? She gets into that. She talks about models in science and models in religion. The chapter, which I haven't read yet, the last chapter, is God the Father, model or idol? ? And I can just see the direction she's going from the understanding of metaphor.
When
it seemed to me that the answer is probably it could be either.
When they were debating transubstantiation, this is
yeah.
my body, and the
yeah.
Calvinists, did anybody talk about metaphor?
I think McFaig would say it would have been very helpful, and we would have saved ourselves a lot of grief if people had understood that they were using metaphor. Yeah. What one section in here is how we tend to become literalistic whenever we collapse similarity into identity, when we forget the is and is not tension in the originating metaphor. And that gets us into trouble all the time, as in this is my body. Yeah. Dan?
As when you were talking a little bit just about in terms of the Trinitarian aspects of God and how renaming them, say from traditional Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, Creator, Redeemer, Sanctifier.
Yeah. Well, that's changing them, of course.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
This whole idea of metaphor makes it so much more helpful for me in realizing both the tremendous exciting potential,
yeah.
but also the risks and and what's involved in say such a change like that. I mean, I'm often very want to sing Creator, Christ, and Holy Spirit.
Yeah.
But in changing, then my concept of God, if I go to Creator, Redeemer, Sanctifier,
yeah.
pretty much is much more of a functional roles of
mm-hmm.
those aspects of God, especially as involved with the created world, rather than a relational role
yeah.
that you have in the Father, Son, and especially
yeah.
relational within the Godhead.
Yeah.
And so it points out so much more of not just what I'm gaining by going maybe
yeah.
towards inclusiveness, but also the things, aspects I'm in danger of losing if I'm not critical and conscious of what the word changes involve.
Of course. One argument for inclusive language is that you don't drop.
Very much.
I mean, you to substitute one for the other, or a so-called substitute, it isn't, but a so-called substitute is not being inclusive. It's true.
Right.
Yeah.
And what I'm saying is so helpful for me from metaphor is it just makes me much more conscious
uh-huh.
of what is hidden and what is not,
uh-huh.
and what is made explicit, and what you gain and what you lose
yeah.
in the exchange.
Yeah.
Interchange.
Sustainer can't sustain many of the same elements that a personal relational term does. Yeah. But it does some other things which a personal relational term may not. Yeah. Mary, and then...
When God brought the animals to Adam to name
mm-hmm.
them,
mm-hmm.
he put himself in a relationship, right? And what I'm getting tonight is that the metaphor that you use determines your relationship with God, doesn't it? And that's what I got out. That's what
yeah.
struck me tonight. That
yeah.
The metaphor that I use will determine how I feel about God or how I perceive God.
Mm-hmm.
Or how I
mm-hmm.
fit in
and you'll have to, if you, it'll take another metaphor to change the relationship. That's right. I can't remember if it's Sally Giselle or in this book where the contention is, and it's the language of philosophy and theology, but the choice of metaphor is the basic hermeneutical act. That is the first and basic hermeneutical act. That is to say, in your interpretation and understanding of something, your choice of metaphor is the single most crucial choice.
So
because things cluster around it, like Polanyi says, things have their logical neighborhoods. And you choose a metaphor, like the snow blankets the ground, all kinds of associations come with that.
So how do we learn to call God mother or think of God as mother? Is it simply education then? Or... I mean, if inner-city kids in D.C. had a hard time calling God father because they had no father and there was no way to relate,
mm-hmm.
that would be easier for them to think of God as mother.
Mm-hmm.
but is it strictly a matter of education, or how I perceive God then to be able to call God mother?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. One thing, just to underscore the importance of the effect of metaphor on perception. If one keeps using the same images all the time, then it will be very hard to even experience God in some other way. But that is in tension with another thing that I think we have to say, namely that metaphor and language, while it shapes our perception, also expresses our experience. And there will be elements in your experience of the world, experience with one another, you know, just all the whole range of experience, which might be the point at which, or from that from which you can draw to say any number of things then about your relationship to God. So unless one is totally devoid of experiences of intimacy or experiences of nurture or experiences of closeness or experiences of gentleness or experiences of strength or whatever, unless you're totally devoid of that, it seems to me that you've got experience funds the metaphors, is a metaphorical way of saying it. Does that, I don't know if I'm addressing your question. I mean, I think both, you have to see how images shape your experience, and at the same time, the experience itself allows a wide range of expressions of it.
It seems though that the hardest ones to give up or change are the relational ones. Like if I say like a rock or like a chicken, I don't see a rock or a chicken. But if I say like, or if I call God Father, I see a father. So that human kind of element, or that human relational.
Well, is that because of the Jewish and Christian tradition, which does, amidst that variety of images which are there, and there's a wide range of them. I just read the Psalms. But amidst that wide variety, there certainly is a kind of priority placed on personal relational images. Is it for that reason? I don't know.
Something that helps me in my own thinking feel the importance of metaphors is the experience of when perhaps a person only knows me in one role or one function or something, and in reference to me, that's the only way they see me or in our relationship, and I can begin to feel very upset and like, but I'm more than that. Don't just put me in that slot. Don't just peg me there. Like, say, a father, that the other aspects of that man's life isn't affirmed, but, you know, always referred to as so-and-so's father, and, you know, you're not let out of that box, or a woman who's always put in the role of being someone's mother instead of, and also, you know, someone who weaves or someone who, you know, drives a bus or, you know, whatever, so that it's very, I feel like it does a violation to the wholeness of a person if I only called, you know, Janet the business manager, you know, well, business manager, how are you doing? It would begin to be absurd, because I think the experience of that other person would be, oh, you know, what is this? So interpersonally, we do this all the time. We use a wealth of images and words and naming of each other, and for ourselves, we imagine ourselves in all sorts of ways. So in using only male language for God, or only, you know, parental images for God, again, that's boxing in and violating, I think, the wholeness of God, And I often imagine the divinity squirming in many ways, like, I am more, you know. So if we can feel that and always long to be allowed to be be growing and more, for me it's very much a kind of a wholeness peace issue. And it's an interpersonal thing at the same time. None of us likes that experience. And if we were more poets and less literalists, it would probably be easier for all of us.
Vern?
One thing I think that would move us along is to eliminate the word is. A good deal of our difficulty hinges on the implied identity implicit in the word is.
Equivalent.
If you said God fathers his children, you would not, or God mothers his children, you would not have the same kind of problems that you have if you have is and a noun. And it's amazing how you can lighten up something.
The is
with
is a word of identity.
With predicates. With predicates. One other comment. I think there's some importance in each of the stages of metaphor. In other words, there's something exciting when a metaphor is fresh, and there is something. There's a different feel to a metaphor that is dead and a metaphorical. I mean, just for example, the face of a cliff doesn't feel like the cliff frowned in the shadows of the sun. So that I'm there's something terribly important in fresh metaphor. George Orwell has a line in his lovely little article on the politics of the English language: never use a metaphor that you are used to seeing in print.
So
you know, there's something. It isn't just to find another canned metaphor, but somehow to become metaphorical. And then one more comment. I think for a metaphor to be nurturing for a whole community, you need a story. You need some kind of story or some kind of classic symbol to anchor it. And we need some of the stories to undergird and some myths to undergird and sustain more.
I suppose in some ways the story gives rise to meaningful metaphors.
Well, a story.
I mean, they're understandable.
Or carries, or. But I don't think a simile will do. Will simply anchor it for a whole community. You need more than a than coining an experience. You really need a myth.
Vince and then Carla, and then I think we'll.
I just want to return a little bit to Janet's question about some of the metaphors are the most difficult to give up. And I wonder how many of those are tied unconsciously or consciously to interests that are power interests or interests that are such as male interests or one of the ones I think of in particular because it threatens so many people is the whole idea of parenting or spousing is usually very much tied into a heterosexual model. And I think of lesbian gay Christians that I know that use the metaphor of God as lover, because so many of the traditional ways of traditional family relationships are not open, or they're seeking, they don't relate to their experience. And yet when they share that image with more traditional groups, it's very jarring and very upsetting oftentimes. The Bible, we use Christ as spouse to a church who is a bride, mm-hmm. but the idea of God as lover really jars a lot of our traditional understanding of heterosexual relationships and family of mother and father, son and child and daughter. So I wonder how much the dominant metaphors that are most difficult to give up are tied to specific interests that have power in society mm-hmm. and in church.
And that's why rock or chicken doesn't elicit.
Not caught on.
Yeah. Carla, I'm conscious of times
like...
No, I cited McFaig saying that she likes to talk about Jesus as the parable of God, and which does make Jesus, in a sense, an extended metaphor of God. Now, that's where it really gets, I think, very significant and very interesting, because then you are saying Jesus both is in some respects like God and is not in some respects like God.
Is like us, is human.
Is, yes, but is in some respects like us and is not in some respects like us.
But Larry, when you say Jesus is a parable, your parable is a predicate. The word Jesus is not a metaphor.
Oh, I know,
the word
but
Jesus
to,
is a name.
To understand Jesus as a parable.
Is like
of God.
Is another way of talking about the divinity of Jesus. Another metaphor for the relationship between God and Jesus.
Yeah, exactly.
But that doesn't make... Oh, okay.
Well, Larry, if you say that, you aren't using something that you absolutely know to identify something you can't know. You're still identifying something you can't know for something you can't know.
As she would explain this, I hope I'm being fair now, the experience of the followers of Jesus was that something they knew intimately was well known to them. The experience of Jesus was their way of talking about the lesser known, namely God.
But wouldn't that only have been true for 12 or 15 people? Maybe? How could it be true for us?
Well, that keeps getting passed down. I mean, we know more about what it means to be human. Jesus was like us in every way, except not sinning. I mean, those records, we know we can identify with Jesus of Nazareth in order to talk about something we know less well, God. And that's so it's the better known to the lesser known.
But only the humanity of Jesus, not Jesus as being human.
Well, that's her point, is that the Christology is, use another metaphor, from the bottom up. I mean, it's from experiencing the human Jesus that one comes up against the question, is this not also a confrontation with the very character of God?